Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning into this NBI podcast. My name is Martin Lefebvre. I'm CIO at National Bank. And today I'm joined with Angelo Katsouris. He's our geopolitical analyst here at the bank. He's been with us since 2008. And prior to that, he worked as a research analyst at La Caisse de dépôt et placement du Québec. He also worked as a risk analyst at the Aon Corporation, which is an insurance brokerage firm. Angelo is a double major in international relations and industrial relations from the University of Toronto, and he holds a master's degree in public policy from Concordia University. Hello, Angelo.
How are you? Thank you for having me.
No problem. We're super happy to have you. Obviously, because you're here, we're going to be discussing geopolitical risks. So why don't we start with the war in Ukraine? Could you provide us with an update on the war in Ukraine, and we'll just take it from there.
Sure. I think for the next few months, the chances of serious peace negotiations are slim because both sides think they can gain ground, right? If you're the Ukrainians, you stop to negotiate now. In their view, you give the Russians more time to reinforce their defenses, bring in more soldiers. If you're the Russians and you stop for negotiations now, you feel this is more time for the West to give Ukrainians more arms and to train them. And I think that if you look perhaps, you know, down 7 or 8 months, if you see the following factors occur, whether it's a deadlock on the ground, worries over munition supplies that the West is able to supply Ukraine, an economy slowing down, public support in Europe and the U.S. starting to maybe decline a bit, you might see, you know, chances for serious peace negotiations towards the end of the year, early 2024, right? Whereas I think there's rumors, some people in the West and, you know, are saying, look, make as much gains as you can over the next 7 months. But after that, we have to start beginning some sort of negotiation. So I think that's where it is today right now. But in terms of the next few months, the chances for any serious negotiations are very slim.
Okay. So how has that impacted the economic growth in parts of Europe? You know, not so long ago, energy went up through the roof, grain prices went up, food prices went up. Everybody was expecting a severe recession late last year, early this year. It didn't happen. Can you tell us why and where we're sitting right now?
There's a few things, right? Europe still has the challenge with energy. Energy prices have fallen, but relatively speaking, natural gas is still much higher in Europe as it would be compared to North America or China. Electricity prices are still much higher, so there's still this disadvantage that they face, right? And one of the things that you have to take into account that they threw trillions of dollars into subsidizing this, and they shut down a lot of industrial production, aluminum, chemicals, things like this. And so this will have longer term ramifications because there's a chance a lot of this production is not going to come back. The leader of BASF, the chemicals company, who's, you know, he said they're going to reduce their footprint, said, look, I have to move some production to China or the US because if we do it only in Europe, we're going to lose a lot of money. So Europe has this longer term, you know, kind of challenge associated with it, right? And then really quickly, Europe over the longer term has what I call the guns versus butter debate, where they're promising we're going to spend a hell of a lot of money on defense, but you've already spent a lot of money on COVID. You spent a lot of money on you know, transitioning to green energy. You spent over $1 trillion subsidizing energy and natural gas related costs. Complicated matters, interest rates are higher. And in some cases, debt levels are higher now in some of these countries than they were during the debt crisis. And then, so you have this challenge, right? And how are you going to manage this, the need for a social safety net with the need for greater defense? And, and that's why I call it guns versus butter. And that France is the example. France about a year ago said, look, we're going to increase defense spending. But then they said, we're going to cut pensions. And what do you see? Riots in the streets, right? So Europe is going to have this challenge of how they balance what I call guns versus butter in terms of navigating this.
So do you feel like the geographic rotation we got early in this year is a bit of a stretch now? From what you're saying, I understand that there's still structural issues in Europe.
Yes, I still think what Europe has the longer term challenges in relation to energy costs, right? And I think that that's going to be a big challenge. And you know, I've been long telling clients, if you're going to focus on Europe and your asset allocation, maybe put more of your asset allocation to those companies, what I call European in name only. They not only produce, they not only sell abroad, but they do a lot of production abroad. So they're less exposed to these energy costs, because like I said, they dropped everywhere, as you mentioned, but Europe still has double or triple and natural gas related costs. They still have much higher electricity costs, And so if you're a company planning for the longer term, so it's a way to look at Europe's allocation from a bit of a different perspective. The ones that are European, but perhaps have a little bit less exposure to Europe itself in terms of production. And then there's just the geography, right? Like, you know, Europe, when you look at it, they're surrounded by instability, right? And it's Belarus, it's Russia, it's Ukraine, it's Turkey, Syria, North Africa. All of these things are going to have to deal with for the longer term, while we're surrounded by two oceans and the United States, right? So geographically, they're very unlucky. And they're going to have this permanently militarized border of 7,000 kilometers, which won't be, you know, very tension-filled border with Russia. So there are these factors to take into account.
Now, last question on Ukraine, and I'm gonna put you on the spot here a little bit, Angelo. What are the odds of first a standstill, same as what we're seeing right now, or an escalation? You know, taking it further, either supersonic missiles and from Russia, or even worse, a nuclear war, or sustainable peace within the next 12 months. So what are the odds? What are you putting? What's your scenario?
In the beginning, as I mentioned before, I think you're going to have an escalation, especially because both sides are going to try to gain ground, in particular the Ukrainians. And the Russians will respond if they lose some ground in the battle. They'll bomb more, because ironically, the better the Ukrainians do in the ground, the more they're going to bomb the cities, right? It's a tale of two wars. You have the ground war, and then you have the economic war, right? Which you try to destroy their infrastructure, keep their economy permanently unstable, lead to 35% reduction in GDP. And even, you know, you look at agriculture, which is a major driver of their, you know, their economy. Well, 20% of their land is covered in bombs, chemicals, unexploded bombs, debris. So even if the war ends tomorrow, you're not going to be able to resume production in these sites for a very long time, right? So I think you're going to have this increase in tensions, increase in bombings, and then, you know, as I mentioned before, over the longer term, let's say 12 months down the road, if you see that this deadlock continues, you see public support beginning to decline in the West and Europe, you see your worries over your munition supplies, because Europe's having a hard time, and the West is, and the US as well, is in providing that. Maybe Russia's economy starts to take some longer term issues with, you know, in terms of revenues. China doesn't get involved in the war and gets involved in negotiations. You take a lot of these factors, and there's the chance for serious, perhaps ceasefire negotiations, right? But it's important to remember, I don't think you see a peace deal. You might see something like akin to the Korean border between the two Koreas, where you're going to have this this frozen conflict, right? That is maintained between two. So it's supposed to a ceasefire negotiation. So I think you have to look at that in terms of all those factors. And if they all come together, then the chances of negotiations, perhaps in 12 months, increases.
Okay, let's take it to China and U.S. tensions,
sure,
if you will. Can you tell us what the key areas of contention between China and the United States are, and what's behind that?
Well, it's, you know what, this, like, just to go back a bit, like, this has been building for a while, right? And for a long time, the biggest surprise was that the U.S. didn't react, right? You mean, for a very long time, you know, even before this began, before Trump, you know, the China could buy, you know, tech companies in the U.S. U.S. couldn't buy Chinese companies. China could buy U.S. farmland. U.S. couldn't do the same, right? China could buy Western automobile companies. The U.S. couldn't do the same. So for a long time, the U.S. was in a knife fight with a baguette, right? And then Trump kind of woke everybody up in a sloppy way. And now we're dealing with this on a, you know, with regard to high tech industries, right? And for a long time, the markets were kind of like a bit blasé to this, right? But I think now we've crossed into what I called unprecedented territory. And part of this is, like, you know, number one, when they had the CHIPS Act, which provides subsidies for building. But this, you know, what this included was that if you take the money to build semiconductor plants in the U.S., you can't build advanced ones in China for 10 years. So you created a precedent, restrictions on outbound investment. You also have restrictions on, you know, selling semiconductors and advanced equipment to China. There's also legislation floating around saying, you know, that could be passed in the next year, saying, look, if you want advanced sectors in countries of concern like China, you need approval in a committee. Now, if this legislation was passed, maybe a company like Tesla would have to ask permission to build an additional battery factory, right? And what this means from, like, an investment perspective, for example, the semiconductor sector, some of these companies, the semiconductor sector, they rely on China for 30% of revenues. So what are they going to do? Number one, they're going to have to focus more on the Western markets. Number two, subsidies, right? $52 billion sounds like a lot of money, but when it costs $20 billion to build one factory, it's not a lot of money. So we're going to have a CHIPS Act 2 in terms of subsidies, a CHIPS Act 3. This is like an example of what I call the subsidies arms race, right? And so we're a long way from the principles of Adam Smith, right? We're seeing Canada do the same, right? So we're going to see these companies saying, okay, you want us to abide by restrictions on sales, and we're going to have to be at least partially compensated by subsidies. So look for all regions to do this. We know Europe's doing this. We know the U.S. is doing this. So we know that Canada's doing this as well. So it's kind of an example. So when we're investing, in addition to profits, revenues, and the quality of a product, you analyze what countries consider to be geopolitically strategic for their needs and what they're willing to provide subsidies to. So it changes a little bit of the outlook when you're analyzing. It adds a wrinkle to your analysis.
So is the chips industry and the semiconductors industry becoming what the energy sector used to be, where it needed to be subsidized at some point? Or
well, it's being considered strategic, right? You're right. In terms of oil and gas back in the day, it was considered strategic, and some analysts will say this is the new oil, right? Because everything functions on it. And the very advanced semiconductors allow you to compete in the AI sectors and to come in advanced military, and America saying, we want to deny these. Another reason is too that America wants to deny them access to advanced machinery need to make advanced semiconductors. That one thing preventing perhaps Taiwan from being invading is with the semiconductor wall, because if you invade Taiwan and you destroy the semiconductor supply chain, it would hurt China tremendously. But if China develops its own ability to produce very, very advanced semiconductor chips, then there's one less reason to not initiate hostilities. And so that's another reason why the U.S. is trying to deny them access to advanced machinery needed to build the most advanced semiconductors. So a lot of this is playing out. It's considered a strategic industry. And when you're analyzing, these strategic industries, which we as investors consider to be, great investments, we have to analyze how they can be impacted in terms of access to both markets. Because some of these companies are not going to be able to have access to both the U.S. and the Chinese market. They're going to decide which one they're going to prioritize and which one they're going to neglect.
So clearly, from what you're saying, this has affected global trade. From now on, there really is going to be two different poles, where North America is going to be trading with one another, and then parts of Asia is going to be more China related.
So yeah, that's it.
That'll be the way to go. That's not just something that was foreseen. We're at the start of that.
And I think one important thing from an investment perspective is when you move these things around, once you gain in national security, you lose in efficiencies, inefficiencies of scale. And again, they become more costly, more redundant supply chains. You're moving into areas which would have been more expensive. And one thing clients should ask is that when you take into account higher operational costs, you have to say to yourself, does the sector or the company in question have the ability to increase their prices to account for the higher operational costs of being forced to rejig their supply chains, right? Maybe an Apple, for example, moving part of its supply chain to India, which would be very costly, will be able to, right? Maybe they won't, but these are things that they take into consideration. We're going to have higher operational costs, and do the sectors in question, are they able to increase the price of their products to compensate for these higher operational costs? So it's another also way that when you rejig these things, what you have to look at from an investment perspective.
So what are the diplomatic measures being taken by either China or the United States to mitigate this escalation of ongoing tensions?
Well, it's off and on.
Yeah, because China is still a very important player. Like we cannot just, set it aside. And
No, it's off and on, because sometimes when the tensions get really high, China cuts off communications. Now they're slowly beginning to talk again, right? They were going to talk before the balloon saga, right? And they cut off communications as well. So that's kind of, and they're in a phase right now where they're perhaps going to talk to each other again. But it's meant to kind of manage the decline in relations, so something doesn't go off the guardrails, right? It's not supposed to save the relationship, to make it not go into a situation where conflict breaks out or things like this, because I think they both realize that the tensions are there for the longer term, right? If you look into an analogy for baseball, nine innings, in terms of tensions, we're in the second inning for them, right? This is a long-term view, but they want to, the perspective is just to keep the talks going so that you avoid the worst-case scenarios. Right. But you're right. It's a lot more difficult to, if you think you had a hard time sanctioning Russia with all the loopholes and things like this, imagine sanctioning a country that accounts for 30% of the world's manufacturing base. Right. 10 times more than India's, for example.
Yeah, just thinking about it is scary. Okay, so we talked about Ukraine and Russia. We talked about the Chinese economy. So let's focus more on the U.S. and especially on the political side of things with the Biden administration, if you want. What kind of challenge do you see and constraints that the Biden administration is facing in achieving its environmental targets?
Well, they, as we know, they put in some place very strict local content requirement rules, right? In terms of trying to build up their alternative energy industries. Yeah. But the problem is when you look at this, is that they mine very little of the minerals needed for electric vehicles and alternative energy, and they refine even less of them. So even if you mine a little bit, you have to send it back to China. So you have this kind of like really tough situation, because on the one hand, if you move as quickly as you can to meet your targets, you go from being independent in oil and gas to being dependent on your number one rival for the minerals and refined components needed for your supply chain. If you slow down to give your supply chains time to hit critical mass, you'll miss your environmental targets by an even wider margin, right? And we hear these news reports of, you know, in the battery factories or battery cell factories being built in Canada, the United States. But if you don't build the refineries here, then you're just as dependent as you were before. So, right. So it's this challenge trying to build it. The problem is you can subsidize these industries, but if you're not able to get the permits to get the mines up and running or the refineries, your dependence will be maintained.
And it China takes kind time, of, right?
It takes a lot of time. It also takes social acceptance, right? You have to convince mm-hmm. people that, you know, for a long time, the West, we considered mining to equal environmental degradation. And now we're turning around telling, especially the younger generation, we need the mines for the green energy revolution, right? You're sending contradictory messages. And overcoming this will be very difficult, right? You'll need to really talk about it and say, look, we have to build these things for national security. And it will be difficult, right? And that, you know, is something which will be a challenge facing not just the United States, but Canada and Europe as well, in terms of, you know, trying to build up that. Otherwise, you create dependencies, which you already massively have right now.
Yeah. What's your, we haven't talked about that, but we see Canada and even the U.S. more and more are kind of putting China aside and try to make, you know, big deals with India, the biggest population out there. So what's your take on that rapidly?
Well, you know what? India is like, I'm seeing a repeat in history in many respects, because back in the 1970s, the U.S. took advantage of tensions between the Soviet Union and China to peel China away from the Soviet Union. And it became a counterbalance to the Soviet Union. It got a lot of investments, and the rest is history. You fast forward today, we look at India as the new counterbalance to China. And the question is, will they benefit from this, right? And, you know, and I think this time they will get more investment for two reasons. Number one, they have made some impressive gains in their logistics in terms of, you know, trains, transportations, and ports. And also, the political tensions between China and the United States are so high that a company like Apple is willing to spend a lot of money mm-hmm. to partially move their production to India and deal with the quality issues and the difficulty and the cost of setting this up because of these tensions, right? Something they would have done 5 years ago. And on a side note, a company like Apple has the money to do this transition and deal with these issues, but a lot of other companies do not, right? So it's going to be very costly to their supply chains. The second thing with India is that we've realized is that India is so important as a counterbalance to China that they can do whatever they want. They can break every Russian sanction in the book because they're too important to get angry. The U.S. needs them as a counterbalance, right? So they can break every sanction with regards to Russia on the book, and there won't be any real serious ramifications for it, right? So I think India will benefit, maybe not, you know, in terms of getting some investment because of these tensions, even though costs will be very high for companies, you know, starting and building this very complicated, you know, ecosystem, you know, just use the example of Apple.
Yeah, I know, I think you're right. Although for a long time, China was perceived as the manufacturer of the world, while India was more like a service-led industry, yep. Like a lot of bright people. Okay, let's go back to the U.S., and we need to finish this with the looming debt ceiling. So yes. Can you tell our audience what the debt ceiling is and why it's important for the functioning of the U.S. economy?
Okay, in simple terms, the debt ceiling basically is a limit, like a limit to how much you can borrow. It's one of the few countries in the world that has this type of situation where you actually, even if you pass a bill, you have to actually get approval after you've hit a certain level of what you can borrow in terms of debt. So the US has about $31 trillion in debt, and they need approval to increase that, right? Usually it's done without much controversy. Every once in a while, when the government's divided, you have a moment like this. Now, I would argue the good news is that at the very last moment, we are going to see a deal, right? The bad news is that the longer you take it to the deadline, the more market turbulence there was. And if we look at 2011 as an example, they waited 2 days before the deadline to sign something. Markets fell about 17%, took about 6 months to recover, right? And you also, to be fair, you had the debt crisis, the European debt crisis back in the day. But this time around, you have a lot of things that make the markets nervous: higher rates, financial sector, geopolitical tensions, the war in Ukraine, et cetera, right? So you have all these things that are going to lead to turbulence. Now, given that it's so close, we have to take into account the small chance that if a debt ceiling does get breached, what happens, right? Now, back in 2011.
How close are we? Janet Yellen just alluded to perhaps running out of money as soon as June 1st. What's your take on that?
Well, she says June 1st is what they call the X day, when there's no more accounting maneuvers you can do. Some private sector analysts say you might have a few more days or even weeks, right? If you can find a way to get to June 15, you get some more corporate taxes coming in, for example. Right. But so June 1st is when she said it. Let's say it could be a few more days if you fool around with the accounting maneuvers again. Right. And so that's the date, official date. But let's say that you could probably add a few more days to that if you really wanted to find ways to stretch it out. Right. Now, if you pass the debt ceiling, there's a couple of scenarios to take into account. That number one, back in 2011, there was a plan at the beginning to prioritize paying, debt payments and cutting back on Medicare or pensions and things like this, so you maintain the viability of the Treasury market, right? So that was the one thing that they were going to plan to do. The second thing is if we broke the debt ceiling, the markets would react so much that probably the Congress would rush back very quickly because the markets would force them to do this, right? And so then the very small chance that we break this debt ceiling, I think this is what would occur. And also just to go back a little bit, it usually takes market panic before it really concentrates minds in Washington. And for the moment, we haven't had that market panic. And in fact, just before this call, the Republicans walked out of negotiations and the markets went into the red a bit. And so we'll see if this is the beginning where the markets pressure them, the corporations pressure them, right, to get this thing done. But the deadline is right. It's fast approaching. It'll be last minute. And we'll see whether June 1st is the actual X day, or it could be a couple of days after. But that's why I feel that the ramifications of breaking this are just too great for them to not do. But we seem to take it closer to the edge every day, every time we have this. So it's not zero to go past the debt ceiling as before would have been considered.
Do you believe in the GOP's plan to raise the debt ceiling, but to curb spending in the years ahead of us? You think Democrats will go for that?
When the Republicans are in opposition, they tend to let this thing go, and they tend to find religion. When Republicans are in power in the presidency, they tend to forget about this, and they tend to find debt religion when they're in opposition. But what the contours of a deal would be when they come to an agreement will be probably returning some of the leftover COVID money, some limits on spending for the next 2 or 3 years. Maybe you'll limit spending increases on the discretionary items by 1%. And what I mean by discretionary is not like things that are fixed like Medicare or pensions, some of the discretionary items. And then perhaps maybe even permitting reform to get more alternative energy infrastructure projects and fossil fuel projects done faster. That's where they are, but they're so far apart on even these issues. Right? You might even have the scenario where they realize they can't agree, and they agree to increase the debt ceiling for 2 months. And we go back to doing the same thing all over again, right? And so I think these are the scenarios, but look for them to move once the markets have panicked, right? And this has been a history in the U.S. Back in 2008, they rejected a bill to bail out some of the financial sector. And then when the markets collapsed, they came back and passed something, right? In 2011, for the debt ceiling, took market panic for them to move. And so we have to wait for a few more red days in the markets for the both sides to kind of get scared into action at the very last moment.
Angelo, as always, very interesting. I could ask questions for hours and you could answer for days, but this is all the time we had today. So thank you again for being with us. And for all of you listening, thank you for watching this MBI podcast, and we'll talk again sometime next month. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.